This is Audible.
The Librarian of Crooked Lane, The Glass Library, Book 1, written by C.J. Archer, performed by Marion Hussey. Chapter 1, London, Spring, 1920. The woman, crouching under the desk near my feet, expelled an unladylike snort of derision. I stilled. I didn't dare urge her to keep quiet with a nudge of my boot for fear that Mr. Parmiter, the head librarian, would notice. At the sound of the snort, he turned back and scrutinized me yet again. He had a way of making me feel like a speck under a microscope. Moments ago, he'd pressed both palms on the desk, leaned in until his face was close to mine, and inspected me with all the rigor of a detective searching for evidence at a crime scene. Indeed, Mr. Parmiter's initial scrutiny had come about because he did suspect me of a crime. The crime of wearing makeup. According to the library charter, which I'd never seen, female staff were forbidden from adding so much as a smudge of color to their cheeks. Although I was sure the rule never existed since I was the first female employee, I didn't question him. I simply informed him I was not wearing makeup. He'd sniffed, as if trying to smell a lie, then turned away. Until Daisy had gone and snorted like a bull at a red rag. Mr. Parmiter scrutinized me again, but this time he stood a foot back from the desk.
Are you unwell, Miss Ash?
No, I said. I was just clearing my throat. Those beady eyes of his narrowed further. He moistened his lips with a lizard-like flicker of his tongue, dampening the overhanging grey moustache. I wouldn't have been surprised if he reached across the desk to touch my forehead, checking for a fever, but the fear of getting too close held him back. I couldn't blame him for that. The Spanish flu had recently wreaked devastation and we all worried it would return.
You should go home if you feel unwell, he said.
I feel fine. He waved a hand at my face.
And remove that vile stuff. This is a respectable institution where gentlemen of learning come for quiet study. Attractive women are a distraction. If it were up to me, I wouldn't have employed someone like you, but needs must.
This last sentence, he muttered as he walked off. Thankfully, Daisy didn't emit another snort. She was probably too shocked and angry to speak. I was just as angry, but not shocked. In the 2 months since I'd taken the position of assistant librarian at the London Philosophical Society's library, I'd been exposed to Mr. Parmiter's misogynism on a regular basis. He blamed young women for just about every ill that had ever befallen him, or the world in general. I'm sure he could find a way to blame us for the war if he put his mind to it. It's safe, I whispered. Daisy crawled out from the desk's footwell and cast a disdainful look in the direction in which Mr. Parmiter had departed. She hadn't seen him leave. It was the only exit from the reading nook. I was using the empty desk to inspect some old books for signs of disrepair. Tucked away on the first floor between the stacks, it was the perfect place for quiet research, or hiding from one's manager while chatting to a friend who shouldn't be in the library at all. Daisy was not a member of the London Philosophical Society. She wasn't at all philosophical. Not even after drinking too many cocktails. A drunk Daisy was a giggling Daisy, not terribly unlike a sober Daisy. But she wasn't giggling now, as she perched herself on the edge of the desk and regarded me with a frown. What did he mean when he said he wouldn't have employed someone like you but needs must? I balanced the book on pragmatism on both my hands, then closed it with a satisfying thunk of its thick pages and heavy leather cover. The smell of old paper wafted up, causing Daisy to cover her nose. I breathed the scent deeply into my lungs. There were no other suitable applicants for the position of assistant librarian, I told her. He had to resort to hiring a female. I rolled my eyes and gave a wry laugh. Really? Even with all the returned soldiers looking for work? There were other applicants, but according to Mr. Parmiter, none were suitable. There were three others, in fact, all returned from the war. One was blind in one eye, another was missing a leg, and the third had shattered nerves that saw him jump at any loud noise. Mr. Parmiter claimed he couldn't employ them because they are a distressing reminder of the war and will put off the society's members.
He truly said that?
I nodded.
After everything those poor souls have been through, and now they have to endure the sneers of people like Priggy Parmiter. And to imply you're only attractive when you're wearing makeup. The nerve of him.
The heat with which he said it was on par with her defense of the returned soldiers. To Daisy, the two wrongs were equally abhorrent.
You're pretty, Sylvia, and don't let a dusty old bore like him tell you otherwise.
I thanked her for the compliment, but to be quite honest, I was no beauty. Not like Daisy, with her blue eyes and strawberry blonde hair cut into a wavy bob that framed her face. The style was very modern, but in the few short months I'd known her, I'd come to realize Daisy followed trends like winter follows autumn. Inevitably, she never settled for very long before moving on to the next thing that caught her eye. Her desire to try new things was understandable. I didn't blame her for shrugging off the heavy blanket that had shrouded the nation after 4 years of war and another 1.5 of the flu. Sometimes, the bleakness had seemed as though it would never end. But, despite their personal losses, some people were ready to move on. Daisy needed to move forward with her life. I hadn't quite reached that point yet.
Speaking of Dusty,
Daisy wrinkled her nose as she pushed away the book I'd been about to inspect for damage. One of the pages had come loose and the corners of several others had been turned over to act as a bookmark. The thin layer of dust on it bothered Daisy more. It had been on the desk for some time, waiting for a librarian to tend to it. Years ago, someone had collected all the books in the library that looked as though they might need to be sent away for repairs and piled them up on this desk in the remotest reading nook in the building. Then, war had broken out. The assistant librarian had died on the battlefields of France, and no one had been employed in his stead until I started work in March. Filling a dead man's shoes wasn't easy, particularly when Mr. Parmiter made it clear my gender meant my work was inferior to my predecessors. But I enjoyed it when he wasn't bothering me. It was quiet. Few members came into the library, and when they did, they preferred to speak to Mr. Parmiter rather than me. The job didn't pay particularly well, but I could walk to work, saving myself the cost of transport. I also got to chat to Daisy when she wasn't in her flat painting, which seemed to be most afternoons, and when she wasn't hiding from Mr. Parmiter, who came upstairs to check on me from time to time. Daisy watched me as I gently opened the book she'd pushed away.
If you must work in a library, why not work in a modern one, with novels?
With all the returning soldiers resuming their previous employment, there are a few jobs for women. I was fortunate to get this one. She sighed.
It's a pity you have to work at all, really.
I looked up, frowning. She looked back at me with sympathy. Don't you have to? I asked.
Oh yes, but we artists don't have a schedule like regular people. We work when the muse strikes. Besides, I was left a little money by my grandparents. It keeps me going.
It was the first time she'd mentioned an inheritance. Daisy's parents lived in Wiltshire and didn't approve of their middle child moving to London. She had an older sister who'd lost her husband in the war and a younger brother who'd signed up upon turning 18 in 1918. Thankfully, he survived. I actually like working, I said, and I meant it. Whether Daisy believed me or not, I never found out. She became distracted by a newspaper discarded on a small table beside the armchair. She flounced into the chair and began to read. I sat too and made notes on the damage to the books, sorting them into different piles according to the type of repairs required. For the many pages with dog-eared corners, I smoothed out the creases with my thumb. It was easy and relaxing work. Although the topics didn't particularly interest me, it was satisfying to know these books would once again be read and valued by the Society's members thanks to my efforts today.
He is the prime article,
Daisy murmured from the armchair. She folded the newspaper in half and turned it to show me what she'd been reading. I couldn't make out much from this distance, however, just a dark-haired man standing on the deck of a yacht.
Handsome, rich, the heir to a title and a war hero. So many virtues in one man.
None of those are virtues, Daisy, except for perhaps being a war hero. He could be selfish and vain for all we know.
You're so unromantic, Sylvia.
I picked up the book on pragmatism and waved it at her. Perhaps I've worked here too long. I smiled, but she took me seriously.
I'm glad you finally agree.
I was referring to this title. I've only been here 2 months.
Long enough.
She glanced around, worried our conversation was being overheard.
If it weren't for me, your days would drag.
I laughed. Daisy's unfailing self-confidence had won me over when we met. If I could bottle it, I would take a sip whenever I felt my own confidence waning. She studied the newspaper article again.
I wonder if he's married.
If not, he soon will be. A paragon like that won't be single for long. The unmarried women of England won't allow it. One of the saddest outcomes of war was that it took young men. Now that we were emerging from the fog, women my age were bemoaning the lack of eligible bachelors. I was not among them. I was still shrouded by the fog. I'd not only lost my brother in the war, but my mother had succumbed to the flu pandemic that had struck down so many in the war's aftermath. They'd been my only family. I'd also left behind friends when I moved to London, not that I had many friends to lose. We'd moved too often to put down deep roots anywhere. But I was determined to make a go of it in London. In the 2.5 months since my arrival, I'd made a friend in Daisy and found gainful employment. It was a foundation I could build on to help me climb out of the fog. In time. What has the Paragon done to warrant an article written about him? I asked.
He attempted to rescue a fisherman and his teenage son while out sailing off the coast of the Isle of Wight. Apparently, he saw their boat capsize and didn't hesitate to dive in and risk his life to save them. They were tangled up in their net underwater and he had to cut it to free them. The son survived, but the father didn't.
How awful.
The article says it was a miracle Mr. Glass didn't drown too. It then goes on to list all the medals he won in the war.
Good Lord. I peered over her shoulder.
What is it? He joined up at the start of the war and survived the entire 4 years on the front lines. He was there for every major battle, and he didn't once get seriously injured.
Then he couldn't have been in every major battle for the entire duration. Besides, the heir to a title would be given something safe to do well away from the enemy.
Not according to this. Gallipoli, the Somme, Ypres, Amiens. He fought in them all. His parents must have been beside themselves with worry. It says here, he is the only child of Lord and Lady Ryecroft.
I read over her shoulder. Mr. Gabriel Glass, Baron and Baroness of Ryecroft. Lady Ryecroft is the famed magician India Glass, née Steele.
Where can a girl meet such a man?
The Isle of Wight, apparently.
I returned to the desk, but instead of picking up a book, I stared out of the window.
The view wasn't interesting. Just the dark grey buildings opposite and a thin layer of cloudy sky above the roofline.
I hardly registered any of it. My mind was elsewhere.
Daisy, does the name India Glass mean anything to you? She shook her head.
No, but I'm not a magician, nor can I afford to buy magical objects. I'm trying to make the inheritance last, and I'm yet to sell a painting.
Does the article say anything else about her?
Just that she gave up practicing watchmaking magic to marry Lord Ryecroft and has been an advisor to the government on magician policies for years. Why? Have you heard of her?
The name rings a bell.
I just couldn't remember why. The memory was there in my mind, just out of reach, buried in the fog.
I lay on my back on the narrow bed in the room I rented at the lodging house and stared at the water stain on the ceiling. I felt tired but pushed against it, wading through the fog as I searched for the name. India Glass. Where had I seen it? I knew I'd seen it, not heard it. That meant it had appeared in a letter or an article, but I rarely read the newspaper. So it must be private correspondence. There was only one person who ever wrote to me. One person whose letters I'd kept. I pushed the chair up against the wardrobe and stood on it, rising onto my toes to reach, cursing my short stature. Fortunately, the suitcase was light. I managed to grasp it without pulling the entire thing down on my head. It was a child's suitcase,
made of tan leather, small enough for a young girl to drag around the country. And drag it I had. Frequent moves accounted for the scratches and patchwork of dents. I opened it on the bed and stared at the remaining contents of my mother's and brother's lives. I'd kept her favorite shawl, made of emerald green silk, with Japanese motifs embroidered throughout, as well as a plain silver ring, two enamel hair combs, and some old photographs of James and Mia's children. James's belongings were just as meager. I'd not seen any point bringing his old clothes with me, so I'd sold them before leaving for London. I'd needed the money. I set aside his pocket watch, war medal, and notebook. I plucked out the two packets of letters, both tied with string. One packet was thick and contained dozens of letters written by my mother and me to James. He'd kept them all, and they'd been returned to us after his death. The other packet contained letters he'd sent to us. I untied the string around them and lightly caressed the topmost envelope. The sight of his neat, precise handwriting brought a fierce ache to my chest. I read each letter, but didn't find any reference to India Glass. Perhaps I'd misremembered, or I'd seen the name elsewhere. I retied the string and, with a heavy sigh, placed the letters back into the suitcase, wedged between the notebook and the bag. I removed the notebook and flipped it open. It had been with James a long time. The leather cover was scratched and faded from its original forest green to the color of a muddy puddle. The pages were crinkled from being damp and drying out, making the whole book fatter than it would have been when new. My brother's dirty fingerprints appeared on almost every page, and the once white paper was now brown from the mud of the Western Front. I'd read the notebook cover to cover after it was returned to us, before storing it in the suitcase with his other belongings. With mother becoming ill and dying, then contracting the flu myself, I'd forgotten about it and not looked at it since. Reading James's words had been painful then, so soon after losing him. It was still painful now, but the initial sharp ache dulled to a throb as I became lost in my search for the name. India Glass. I scanned the pages, not wanting to read every word. That would only make the ache in my chest swell again. The pages were filled with James's thoughts, some forming complete sentences, others merely fragments of ideas in the form of single words or a sketch. He'd been a good artist. I found the name near the end. It was on a line of its own and didn't form part of a sentence. It was just those two words, India Glass, which I thought meant glass from India when I first read it, perhaps referring to a vase or trinket. I'd not wondered why my brother would be making notes on glassware from a country he'd never been to, but back then, I'd been too grief-stricken to think clearly about anything. Knowing the words were in fact a name gave the notes above and below it new meaning. When I'd first read them, I'd been shocked to learn my brother thought he was a silversmith magician simply because he liked silver things. Who didn't like silver things? I was partial to jewelry set in silver, but I preferred gold. I owned neither, unless I counted the silver band of my mother's. Magic couldn't possibly run in our blood. We were unremarkable. Mother had been a seamstress, James a teacher, and I'd written articles for several local newspapers and journals before that work dried up when the soldiers returned in large numbers. Female journalists were once again relegated to the sections on cookery, housekeeping, and fashion, none being topics in which I could claim any expertise or flair. The Ashes weren't craftspeople. We were just a family with dissimilar interests. I fought back tears as I removed Mother's ring from the suitcase and slipped it on my finger. It fit my middle one. It was simple, plain, and thin, not a special item at all. I felt nothing as I touched it. Wasn't I supposed to feel something if it had silver magic in it? Or did only other magicians feel magic? I didn't know how it worked. I couldn't afford magician-made things, so I'd never bothered to learn about magic. I returned to the notebook. According to James's notes, he'd asked Mother about silver magic and she'd told him he was mistaken and to not bring it up again. below the name India Glass. He'd written the word answers, followed by a question mark. Answers to what? To the question of whether the Ash family could perform silver magic. I closed the book and returned it and the suitcase to the space above the wardrobe. I fell asleep and thought no more about India Glass, silver magic, or my brother until the following morning, when I returned to the reading nook on the first floor of the library and spotted the newspaper Daisy had been reading. War Hero Saves Boy in Miraculous Underwater Rescue, the attention-grabbing headline read. The image of the brave rescuer stared back at the camera. Gabriel Glass looked a little annoyed by the attention, as if he wanted to shout at the journalists to leave him alone. As a former journalist, I'd been told to go away many times. I'd lacked the confidence to insist where my colleagues had persisted. It was probably why I was one of the first women to lose their jobs when the journalists turned soldiers returned from the war. I placed the newspaper in the desk drawer and worked until Daisy snuck into the library. When she flopped into the armchair with a dramatic sigh of boredom, I handed it to her. She frowned.
Are you trying to tell me something?
I want to meet his mother, India Glass, Lady Rycroft. She sat up straight.
If you think the way to a man is through his mother, you know even less about men than I thought you did.
I bristled.
I know as much about men as you, Daisy.
She battled with a smile.
Dear, sweet Sylvia, have you exchanged more than a good afternoon with a single man since arriving in London?
I opened my mouth to answer her, but she put up a finger to stop me.
Priggy Parmiter doesn't count.
I snatched the newspaper from her. I'm not interested in meeting Gabriel Glass. I'm interested in his mother,
Lady Rycroft. Why?
Footsteps on the staircase cut off my answer.
Blast! Hide, Daisy, quickly.
She dove into the cavity under the desk, tucking her legs into her body. I stood behind the desk, blocking the view to the cavity as best as I could in case Mr. Parmiter decided to come around to my side. I smiled and pretended to listen as the head librarian complained about a particular member who hadn't returned a book that was now well overdue. I was actually thinking about my brother's claim that he might be a silver magician and our mother's denial. Although I agreed with my mother, I felt as though I owed it to James's memory to find out once and for all. If he believed India Glass could provide answers, then I would do everything I could to speak with her. But first, I had to find her.
Chapter 2. After Mr. Parmiter departed and Daisy once again crawled out from beneath the desk, I told her about my brother's notebook and his notion that we were silver magicians. She didn't laugh or think him peculiar. She took it in her stride. I was beginning to think nothing fazed her. She became enthused by the idea of finding Lady Rycroft and immediately put her mind to how we could engineer a meeting. Daisy was naturally excitable. The first time she snuck into the library, she looked as though she'd stumbled upon a pot of money when she joined me in the stacks. But she was simply thrilled to have correctly guessed the number of steps leading up to the society's front door. She sat in the armchair and stared down at the photograph of Gabriel Glass in the newspaper, her brow furrowed in concentration.
It may be easier to find Lady Rycroft through her son. After all, he probably attends society parties, dinners, that sort of thing.
Yes, but we don't attend society parties and dinners. I'm a librarian and you're an artist. I almost added that she was an artist of no repute, but that was a little mean. Just because she didn't make a living off her art didn't mean she wasn't very good. Many famous artists had been virtually unknown in their lifetime. For all I knew, Daisy was the same. Since I was no art expert, I would refrain from voicing an opinion on her style. Although secretly, I'd vowed not to hang anything of hers in a prominent place. They weren't to my taste. Daisy continued to frown at the newspaper.
Do you think it's odd that James wrote India Glass in his notebook and not Lady Rycroft?
I asked.
It's not like him to be disrespectful. Perhaps he knew her personally.
Daisy gasped.
Perhaps they were having an affair.
That's highly unlikely, considering she must be at least 50, and he was only 26 when he died.
There's nothing wrong with an older woman being with a younger man.
No, but my brother was not in the habit of having affairs with married women.
Perhaps the husband is dead.
If he was, your war hero would be Lord Rycroft now, but he's simply reported as Gabriel Glass.
Good point. Nothing gets past you, Sylvia. It must be your journalist's keen eye for detail.
When I told her I'd been a journalist during the war, she'd thought it a most interesting career. She'd continued to scour the employment advertisements for journalism positions for me, even after I'd given up and taken the job at the library. It wouldn't surprise me if she continued to check even now.
Anyway, where would James have met a baroness?
I continued.
I don't know where he met her, but I think I know where we can meet her.
She slipped off her Oxfords and curled her feet under her on the armchair.
Do you remember my painter friend Horatio? He's exhibiting at the Royal Academy summer exhibition this year, and I believe the private viewing starts tomorrow.
She gave a pert little twitch of her shoulders and grinned at me in triumph. I gave her a blank look. I don't understand the connection to Lady Rycroft. Does the exhibition have something to do with magic?
The private viewing of the Royal Academy summer exhibition is a key event on the London social calendar. Lords and ladies will be in attendance.
She waved the newspaper at me.
If we get in, we can find her and ask her if she knew James.
It would require diplomacy, but I'd manufactured introductions before in my work as a journalist. This time, it was more important. It was personal, and I found I wanted to know more about James and his thoughts in his final weeks and months. It was a way of honoring him, and a way of climbing out of the fog.
Do you think Horatio will agree to help us get into the private viewing?
She smiled a secret smile.
Oh yes, he owes me a favor.
Her smile suddenly vanished, as her gaze focused on something behind me.
Bloody hell.
I knew it.
Mr. Parmiter charged up to the desk, a finger pointed at me like a weapon.
I knew you were hiding someone up here.
I stepped back. I'm sorry, Mr. Parmiter. Daisy was just leaving. She only came to show me a newspaper article about,
her brother's friend.
Daisy flashed the newspaper at him.
Sylvia has been searching for him ever since the war ended. It's why she came to London, but she hasn't managed to find any sign of him. She'll think she's getting close, then wham!
She smacked the newspaper down on the desk, causing both Mr. Parmiter and me to jump in fright.
He disappears! Until now.
She pointed at the photograph of Gabriel Glass.
You wouldn't deny her the opportunity to find out more about her poor departed brother's friend, would you?
Mr. Parmiter grasped the lapels of his jacket as if they were the edges of an academic gown and peered down his nose at her.
I am not denying her anything, young lady. Your discovery could have waited until she finished work.
Why should she wait a moment longer?
He glared pointedly at her shoes positioned by the chair.
Kindly get dressed and leave.
Daisy straightened and threw her shoulders back, ready for battle. I intervened before she engaged and cost me my job.
I'll speak to you later, I said quickly.
Her lips flattened, but she gave in. She slipped on her shoes, retied the laces, and marched off, casting a final glare over her shoulder at Mr. Parmiter. Once she was gone, he turned to me. He regarded me like a strict schoolmaster with a mixture of self-righteousness and authoritarianism. It was maddening, but I couldn't walk away like Daisy had.
Are you aware how fortunate you are to have a job here at all, Miss Ash?
Yes, sir.
I run a tight ship. I don't abide having my rules broken. They are there for a reason. First, the makeup, and now allowing your friend to wander about the library unsupervised.
He paused, perhaps waiting for me to utter an apology. I simply picked up a book that was missing its front cover and inspected it for further damage. I might not dare try to defend myself, but I could simply not speak. It was a protest, of sorts. It didn't deter him.
Our noble institution cannot be treated so cavalierly. It must be respected. The charter rules must be obeyed. If everyone disobeyed the rules, where would we be?
I couldn't stay silent any longer. May I see the charter, please? He stretched his neck out of his collar and cleared his throat.
This is your final warning, Miss Ash. Overstep again, and I'll have no choice but to dismiss you.
He strode off. I watched him go, then sat with a sigh. I should have insisted on seeing the so-called charter. I'd wager he couldn't provide it.
Chin up, old girl.
I swallowed my gasp, which only caused me to cough. Daisy grinned at me. She must have hidden in the stacks instead of leaving.
I wanted to make sure you were all right before I go.
I'm fine, thank you.
I think he believed the story about your brother's friend.
She indicated the newspaper.
I'll speak to Horatio now. See you later, Sylvia.
She tiptoed off, wiggling her fingers at me in a wave. I smiled. The more I got to know her, the more I liked her. I could curse Daisy. If I'd wanted to work in service, I would have applied for jobs as a maid when I came to London. Offering platters of food to well-heeled guests at the Royal Academy of Arts private viewing had not been my plan for Saturday. I'd hoped to mingle with them, not be ignored by them. I suppose I shouldn't have expected Daisy's friend to just hand me an invitation to the exclusive event. I'd never blend in anyway. The ladies were dressed in the latest styles and dripped with jewels. They sparkled more than the chandeliers overhead. My best dress and mother's ring were too plain. To add insult to injury, Daisy spent more time flirting with one of the waiters than working, while I did my best to do the job I was employed to do and still search for Lady Rycroft. I offered the pastries to a cluster of ladies and gentlemen positioned in front of the wall of landscapes. The framed paintings depicted bucolic scenes with country cottages, rolling green hills, and grazing cattle. Some were quite beautiful. I could stare at them all day and imagine myself enjoying a picnic beneath a shady oak. There wasn't a single reminder of the war in any of them. The group ignored me and continued chatting about their estates and people they knew. They sounded as though they hadn't seen one another in months. I ought not to feel slighted. I was dressed in black, designed to disappear into the background, and no one wanted hors d'oeuvres at this hour. Most would have just come from lunch. At least I was in good company. The paintings and artists were ignored too. I spotted Horatio chatting to two other fellows he'd introduced me to earlier as friends who were also exhibiting. With hair meeting their collars instead of cut short, and wearing cravats rather than ties, they looked like fish out of water as they studied an oil painting. When a middle-aged woman dressed all in black joined them, they were all smiles. They seemed to know her, and even revere her. She must be an art lover and potential customer, going by the way they fell over themselves to talk to her. She touched Horatio's chest with the flat of her hand, so perhaps she was a lover of artists as well as their work. It would seem older women and younger men weren't such an unusual combination after all. I wondered if Daisy knew. She seemed quite keen on Horatio. Her eyes lit up when she spoke about him, and she was eager to include him in our search for Lady Rycroft. I attempted to offload more pastries, but had little luck. Nor did I have any luck finding Lady Rycroft, although it was too soon to give up. I'd begun my search in the main room, but there were many more galleries, each filled with invited guests. The one good thing about being ignored was that it meant I could move between groups and listen for Lady Rycroft's name. I didn't know what she looked like. Horatio hadn't met her either, but he'd promised to let me know if he heard she was here. Unlike the service staff, the artists could mingle, and he had a greater opportunity to meet her than Daisy or me. Daisy approached, a tray of oysters balanced on her hand.
"He's here," she whispered. "He who? We're looking for Lady Rycroft, not a man." "Her son, the Paragon. I recognized him from his photograph in the newspaper."
Her lips curled into a smile.
"He's even better looking in real life."
"I suppose we could ask him which one is his mother." I glanced around at the ladies nearby, one of which was looking down her nose at us.
"You'd better go."
I hissed at Daisy.
Come with me to the basement where we can talk. I can't leave yet. I have to finish serving these. She walked off, bumping me hard in the shoulder. I lost my balance and the tray tumbled to the floor with a clatter, sending pastries scattering.
Nearby conversation stopped. Everyone turned to look. With my face flaming, I bent to gather up the pastries. The waiter who'd been flirting with Daisy in the basement earlier crouched next to me and helped. Daisy was suddenly nowhere to be seen.
Are you all right?
He asked quietly. Yes, thank you for helping. I appreciate it.
First time?
Is it that obvious? He flashed me a grin. It softened his strong features, turning him from a rather fierce-looking man into a friendly one. He had brown skin, and when he stood up, I realized how tall he was. He towered over me. He was well-built, too, with a frame that strained against the stiff, formal livery. The collar looked as though it was strangling him, but he continued to smile at me as if nothing bothered him. The butler, Mr. Ludlow, appeared out of the crowd, his nostrils flaring like a raging bull's. No smile would soften his fierce looks.
Get back to work,
he growled, his voice guttural.
You, new girl, take those back to the kitchen and fetch fresh ones.
I shot a smile of thanks to the waiter who'd helped me and hurried away, wending my way through the crowd and exiting the main gallery into a smaller gallery with more oil paintings, and after that, an even smaller room showcasing watercolors and miniatures. This led to the stairs down to the basement service area, where the staff bustled to and from the kitchen, carrying platters of food and glasses of champagne. Daisy was waiting for me.
Don't glare at me, Sylvia. I did you a favor. We need to talk. It was embarrassing.
She waved off my concern.
You'll never see those people again. Anyway, you're forgetting why we're here. It's to find Lady Rycroft, not serve snobs with nothing better to do than gossip when they should be admiring the art. I don't think a single one of them cares about the paintings.
I shoved the tray at her. She put it down on a side table. We were in the long corridor that led to the kitchen and other service rooms, where staff assembled hors d'oeuvres on platters and ushered the waiters and waitresses off with a flap of their aprons. No one paid us any attention, but it wouldn't be long before the butler came down the stairs. After the debacle upstairs, he might dismiss me altogether.
Do you have a plan?
I asked Daisy.
I do, as it happens. You should speak to Gabriel Glass. Ask him where to find his mother, since she doesn't appear to be here.
I can't approach a stranger and ask him where his mother lives.
If you don't, you'll lose your only opportunity to find her. Do you want to find her or not?
Of course. She nodded at the stairs leading back up to the galleries.
Then go. He was in the sculpture room, the one at the back, not the central one. You'll recognize him when you see him.
She handed me the tray and gave me a little shove toward the stairs.
I can't serve these. They fell on the floor. No one will notice. Anyway, it'll be amusing to see those snobs eating them.
They're not eating at all. She clicked her tongue.
Typical. Now go, or I'll do it instead, except I'll forget to ask him about his mother because I'll be too busy flirting.
I headed back up the stairs, only to be accosted by the nostril-flaring butler, hand up to halt me like a traffic policeman.
Did you get fresh ones?
Of course. I quickly sidestepped around him and hurried off, ignoring his hissed command for me to wait. As Daisy said, I wouldn't see these people again after today, and I was quite fed up with waitressing. I wanted to speak to Mr. Glass and get out as quickly as possible. The exhibition was held across several rooms of Burlington House, the home of the Royal Academy of Arts. Before the invited attendees arrived, I'd been given a brief tour along with the other new staff, so I knew where to find the sculpture room at the back. Being small and the crowd thick, I had to occasionally ask guests to step out of my way. The disdainful looks I received for my impertinence were the most attention I'd received all day. I looked all around the sculpture room, but Mr. Glass was not there. I moved through the adjoining rooms, no longer bothering to ask guests if they wanted an hors d'oeuvre. Finally, I found my quarry in the large room with the oil paintings where I'd made a spectacle of myself. He was easy to spot, not merely because he was tall enough to be seen over the heads of the rest of the crowd, but also because a collection of young ladies hovered in his vicinity, no doubt drawn by his magnetism. He was undeniably handsome, but it was more than his height and good looks that drew the gazes of both men and women. He nodded as his companions talked, genuinely interested in what they had to say. He never interrupted, only answering when they appeared to ask for his opinion on a painting. His bearing was erect but not stiff, his gaze direct but without judgment. And his smile, it made everyone else smile in response. He stood with Horatio and the other people I'd seen Horatio talking to earlier, two artist friends and the elegant woman dressed in black. The gaggle of young ladies did not intrude, but they were clearly orbiting the small group in an attempt to catch Mr. Glass's attention. Their attempts failed. The woman in black took Mr. Glass's arm and steered him to a gilt-framed seascape of an ocean liner powering through the silver-crested waves. The artists followed, and the young ladies edged along too, pretending to admire the same painting. The middle-aged woman claimed his entire attention as she indicated the steam billowing from the ship's funnels, blending into the clouds until it was impossible to tell where steam ended and sky began. Mr. Glass nodded along. I couldn't tell if he was merely being polite or if he genuinely liked the painting. It seemed well executed to me, and I would happily hang it on my wall if I could afford it. With so many people around him, I had no hope of speaking to Mr. Glass in private. I was considering how to proceed when Horatio signaled for me to approach with a jerk of his head. Daisy's friend was an intriguing fellow. When I'd first met him, I'd thought him to be in his early 20s, like me. He was always dressed in his artist's overalls with a dash of paint on either his forehead or cheek, his slender frame in need of feeding. But now that I saw him dressed in a formal suit, his brown hair slicked back instead of sticking up as if he'd not combed it for days, I wondered if he was closer to 30 or even older. He wasn't handsome. In fact, his sharp nose made him look somewhat mousy, but his big eyes saved him, that and his friendly nature. If he wanted to take a lover, he probably wouldn't have much difficulty finding one. I just wasn't entirely sure if the lovers would be men or women. As I drew closer, Horatio stole Mr. Glass from the woman's side and steered him towards me. It was done so quickly and deftly that she took a moment to realize. That moment was long enough for me to introduce myself. The focus with which Mr. Glass had given the painting was now turned entirely onto me. Daisy was right. He was more handsome in person than in the newspaper photograph. It was difficult to pinpoint the reason why. His features were unremarkable when considered separately, but put together, he was perfectly arranged. The sculptures in the other galleries were bland in comparison, and I doubted a portrait artist could capture the precise shade of green for his eyes. The woman dressed in black, whom he'd been talking to, wore an emerald necklace almost the right color. But Mr. Glass's eyes had flecks of a lighter shade in them that made his gaze compelling. Everything about him was compelling, so much so that I froze. The more I realized I had only moments in which to speak to him before the glowering woman joined us, the more my mouth refused to work. I was pathetic. Thankfully, Horatio saved me.
Forgive us for the ambush, Mr. Glass, but it's important. Miss Ash here needs to speak to your mother.
My mother?
Even his voice was lovely, dark and velvety like his hair. He waited for me to speak. When I didn't, he arched his brows, and a small smile tugged at his lips. He found my awkwardness amusing. I found that rather infuriating. With my anger directed outward instead of in, I was able to finally find my voice.
My brother thought our family might be silver magicians and seemed to believe Lady Rycroft could help him discover if we are or not.
It sounded somewhat foolish now that I voiced it to this stranger in the middle of a crowded room as his companions bore down on us. Mr. Glass didn't look at me as though he thought me foolish. He looked as though I'd piqued his curiosity.
Why does he think that?
I don't know.
There must be a reason.
His voice held a hint of urgency. I blinked, taken aback by his sudden steeliness. I suppose there must. He glanced over my shoulder and gave a slight shake of his head at whoever stood there. I turned to look, but I only saw the tall waiter who'd assisted me earlier. I ought to leave before the butler noticed I'd accosted one of the guests and dismissed me on the spot.
You should ask him,
Mr. Glass said. It took me a moment to realize he meant my brother. I can't. He died in the war. Mr. Glass stilled. He regarded me with those eyes of his, full of sympathy and something deeper and darker. Something troubling.
I'm sorry.
Horatio cleared his throat. Sylvia, you should go. I followed his gaze to the butler storming toward us, parting the crowd like the prow of the ship in the painting, nostrils expanding with every heaving breath.
I'm afraid you can't speak to my mother,
Mr. Glass said to me.
But I must.
It was fortunate that I was still holding the tray, or I might have grabbed him with both hands. Sir, please, I believe Lady Rycroft can help. My brother certainly thought so, and he was very smart. He wouldn't have written her name down if it wasn't important. Sir, I need to understand where I come from. Mr. Glass grasped my arms, but it wasn't his firm grip that stopped my prattling. It was the shock at my own words. I need to understand where I come from. I had never known my father. My mother never spoke about him. I knew from a very young age not to ask questions. I didn't even know his first name. I thought I'd not wanted to know him. But now I realized I did. And very much. And so had my brother. Perhaps James had found a clue that indicated our father was a silver magician and that somehow India Glass, Lady Rycroft, could help locate him. She was, after all, a famous magician. It wasn't unreasonable to assume she knew other magicians.
Please, let me speak to your mother, sir,
I whispered through trembling lips. Mr. Glass regarded me with an intense gaze that made my heart quicken and my face heat.
I would, but she's gone.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
His brows drew together in a small frown before clearing. He gave me that smile again, the one that hinted at his amusement at my expense.
She's gone to America. She and my father left yesterday.
Oh, gone only yesterday. I'd been so close. If only I'd learned about India Glass earlier. If only I'd been more interested in my brother's notebook. If only. If only. When will she return?
It wasn't until he let me go that I realized Mr. Glass had held on to me the entire time. His grip had been steadying, and now I felt myself weaken. The tray was too heavy. I was going to drop it and make a fool of myself again, but this time it would be so much worse because the compelling Mr. Glass was watching.
Excuse me, sir. I am sorry she's bothering you,
said the butler, Mr. Ludlow, with a disapproving pinch of his lips.
She's no bother,
Mr. Glass said.
Miss, if you would come with me.
Mr. Ludlow couldn't even remember my name. I might be employed on a temporary basis, but he could at least bother to learn my name.
Ash, I said automatically. My name is Sylvia Ash.
The butler bristled.
I said, come with me.
I looked from him to Horatio to Daisy, who joined us, her tray of hors d'oeuvres nowhere in sight. She arched her brows, asking me if I was all right. She looked worried.
What's going on here?
The woman wearing the black dress and emerald necklace asked.
Why are you not working, girl?
She sounded like Daisy when she aped the upper classes, pronouncing girl as gel.
We were just having a conversation, Mr. Glass said. No harm done.
On the contrary, she shouldn't be talking to you. The only word that girl should say is pastry as she offers them around.
She indicated the platter in my hands. The thing hadn't weighed much when I first picked it up, but now it seemed as heavy as a stack of books.
Ludlow.
The butler drew in his chin, weakening it even further.
My apologies, Lady Stanhope. I'll see that she's escorted from the premises immediately.
He stepped aside and indicated I should walk ahead of him.
This isn't necessary, Mr. Glass said. Please allow Miss Ash to continue to work. The blame is mine alone.
It was gallant of him to say so, but it was too late. Neither Lady Stanhope nor Mr. Ludlow could back down now. Everyone was looking, including the other staff. Mr. Ludlow had to maintain his authority, and Lady Stanhope wouldn't want her friends to see her pandering to a servant.
Now, Miss Ash,
Mr. Ludlow ground out between unmoving lips. Mr. Glass opened his mouth to protest again, so I got in first.
It's all right, I'm going.
I handed the platter to Daisy and walked off.
Do try a pastry,
I heard Daisy say ever so sweetly.
They're delicious.
I glanced over my shoulder to see Lady Stanhope pluck a pastry off the platter. She popped it in her mouth and Daisy snickered, spun on her heel, and followed me. We returned to the basement to change out of the maid's uniforms. I wanted to go directly to the exit, but Daisy wanted to be paid. She went in search of Mr. Ludlow.
The wage wasn't the point of the exercise, I said, trying to keep up with her long strides.
We ought to be compensated for our time.
She asked one of the cooks if she'd seen Mr. Ludlow, but received a shrug in response, and a smirk. We received a lot of smirks and odd looks as we searched for the butler. It would seem our confrontation upstairs was fodder for gossip downstairs.
Miss Ash.
My heart skipped a beat. Mr. Ludlow may not be my regular employer and I may never see him again, but his bark still managed to shred my nerves.
What are you doing here?
Daisy marched up to him.
Looking for you? We'd like to be paid.
You're lucky I don't call the police on you. Get out.
He opened the door that led to a set of steps. Daisy planted her hands on her hips.
Pay us, or I'll make an even bigger commotion.
Mr. Ludlow's lips went white from pursing. Daisy grabbed my hand.
Come on, Sylvia. I think the main gallery had the most people, don't you?
She dragged me off along the corridor.
Wait, wait. Very well. I'll pay you for the hours you worked, not a penny more.
Mr. Ludlow disappeared into his office and returned with an envelope for each of us.
Now get out.
I slunk toward the door. I just wanted to leave. For someone who loathed attention, the day had been exhausting. There was only so much public humiliation one could take. Daisy checked the contents of her envelope before following me. At the door, she turned back to Mr. Ludlow, gestured rudely, and slammed the door behind her.
Bully,
she said as we climbed the stairs. He's only doing his job, Daisy.
I blame that woman. If it weren't for her carrying on like the Queen of Sheba, Mr. Ludlow would never have noticed you talking to Mr. Glass. She was rude, not to mention a dreadful snob. She got what she deserved, though. I hope she choked on a dirty pastry.
She pushed open the door and we emerged onto the courtyard. It was still busy with ladies and gentlemen arriving for the exhibition while others departed after getting their fill of art and gossip.
You spat in those pastries, didn't you?
The deep voice startled a gasp out of me. I pressed a hand to my rapidly beating heart.
Mr. Glass, no, of course not. There was nothing wrong with the pastries. They were perfectly acceptable.
So, if Lady Stanhope thought they had an unusual flavor, it's not your fault?
He was smiling again. I found it unnerving. Was he trying to catch us out? Was he going to report to Mr. Ludlow that we'd served food that had fallen on the floor? Daisy had no such qualms. She put out her hand, which he shook.
Daisy Carmichael, at your service. This is my friend, Sylvia Ash.
How do you do?
He shook my hand too, then indicated we should walk with him across the courtyard.
Ordinarily, I'd introduce myself, but you seem to already know me. May I ask how?
He addressed the question to me, so I answered. We read about you in the newspaper. He rolled his eyes to the sky.
That damned article. I didn't want any part of it, but before I knew what was happening, the photographer was shoving his camera in my face and the journalist was noting down everything I said. Don't believe what you read. He got a lot wrong. So, how did that lead you here?
Daisy heard that the private viewing is one of the main events on the social calendar and that people like you and your mother are invited.
People like us?
He huffed a humorless laugh. I think I'd offended him.
My parents try to come every year. They're great patrons of the arts. When my mother couldn't make it this year, she asked me to attend in her stead.
I'd definitely offended him, going by his tone. Daisy's friend, Horatio, is one of the exhibiting artists, and he managed to secure us employment.
We don't usually work in service, Daisy said.
His wry smirk reappeared.
Is that so?
That Lady Stanhope is horrid. Is she a friend of yours?
We'd never met before today. She's married to one of the Academy's honorary members, Sir Richard Stanhope. She arranges the private viewing, extending invitations, making sure the artists show up, that sort of thing.
No wonder she wants everything to run smoothly, I said. She must put in a lot of effort.
That doesn't give her a license to be rude to the staff, Daisy said.
Mr. Glass agreed.
It does not.
You didn't have to leave the exhibition in protest over the way she treated us, I said.
I didn't.
Oh. Of course he hadn't. I was a fool for thinking his departure had anything to do with that confrontation. He'd simply happened to leave the exhibition at the same time as us. This meeting was purely coincidental. The only reason it was so lengthy was because he hadn't thought of a way to politely disengage. We passed through the arched gateway onto Piccadilly, where a motor car pulled up and two well-dressed passengers stepped out. How long will it be before Lady Rycroft returns to England? I asked.
I don't know.
Mr. Glass glanced along Piccadilly at the steady stream of automobiles and wagons being held up by a single horse-drawn cart. The honks of horns made no impact on either horse or driver. Mr. Glass raised a hand, signalling to one of the motor cars in the queue. I indicated to Daisy that we should leave, but she wasn't ready.
Mr. Glass, will you ask your mother to write to Sylvia? Her address is...
I'm afraid not.
Why not?
Daisy, I urged. Leave Mr. Glass alone. It doesn't matter.
It does matter.
My mother doesn't know any silver magicians, Mr. Glass said.
Daisy frowned.
How can you possibly know that?
Miss Ash, I suggest you try the Silversmiths Guild. They'll know if your family were ever silversmiths, even if they can't tell you definitively if they were magicians.
It was a logical step, but not one that had occurred to either Daisy or me. We'd become fixated on India Glass.
Yes, of course. I'm sorry to have bothered you.
You're no bother.
Daisy seemed intent on proving him wrong, however.
If it was as simple as calling on the guild, her brother wouldn't have written down the name India Glass in his notebook, would he?
Mr. Glass smiled tightly.
I'm sorry, I can't be of help. If you'll excuse me, my motor is here.
A large black automobile suddenly moved out from behind the horse-drawn cart, cut in front of it, then veered towards us. It halted with a screech of tyres. Mr. Glass frowned at it.
Dodson, what the...
A heavyset man sprang out of the motor car and roughly grabbed Mr. Glass's arms, twisting them behind his back. He tried to fight the man off, but he was a solid brute and had a firm hold. He wrestled Mr. Glass toward the open door of the car as the driver revved the engine. It all happened so quickly that it took those of us in the vicinity a second or two to realize Mr. Glass was being kidnapped. When the horror finally registered, I did what came naturally. I screamed. Chapter 3. Daisy screamed too. The piercing sound was like a slap to the face, jolting me into action. I kicked the kidnapper in the back of the knee. His leg buckled. He did not let Mr. Glass go, but his grip must have loosened enough for Mr. Glass to free himself, because all of a sudden, the tables were turned. Mr. Glass had the thug in a headlock.
Let him go or I'll shoot,
growled a man from inside the motor car. With a curse, Mr. Glass released the brute and watched helplessly as he dove into the back seat. With a roar of its engine, the motor car sped away.
Gabe!
The tall, dark waiter who'd been kind to me ran up to us, surprisingly fast considering he was built like a heavyweight pugilist. He grasped Mr. Glass's shoulders and inspected him.
Thank God you're all right.
Mr. Glass sucked in deep breaths of air and nodded.
They got away.
They? The driver and a third man in the back seat. All I saw was the barrel of a gun pointed at me. I couldn't see his face.
Mr. Glass glared in the direction it had fled. The motor already disappeared from view. He drew in another deep breath, which seemed to refill his emptied lungs.
I thought it was Dodson.
Another large black motor car stopped at the curb. It looked very similar to the kidnapper's motor. Mr. Glass greeted his chauffeur.
The kidnapper's car wasn't a Hudson,
the waiter pointed out. Mr. Glass dragged a hand through his hair and sighed. He'd lost his hat during the scuffle.
And mine is. Thank you for stating the obvious, Alex.
The waiter glared at Daisy and me.
I see you were distracted. Don't, Alex.
But the waiter ignored him and powered on.
You're not regular staff.
It was said with an accusatory glare and a crossing of his arms over his chest.
Today was your first day.
Have you been spying on us?
When he didn't respond, Daisy scoffed.
I should have known there was another motive for your kindness earlier. I mean, you obviously weren't flirting with me. You're absolutely dreadful at it. I've had less wooden conversations with a railway sleeper.
Alex's jaw firmed.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
Daisy planted a hand on her hip.
We're not answering that.
Alex stepped closer until Mr. Glass put a hand to his arm.
Not answering makes you look suspicious, so I advise you to speak up.
Alex snarled.
You think we're suspicious?
She scoffed again.
If anyone is suspicious here, it's you two. You seem